Welcome back. This is Lindsay.
And Robert.
And you're listening to The Weightless Space, Episode 5. And today's title is, why don't you tell us?
I Want to Believe.
You know, that is my favorite show, my favorite TV show growing up. It was X-Files, and that's kind of the slogan.
It's a pretty great show.
It is.
In that show, you have a believer and a non-believer.
That's how it starts.
That's true. That's true.
That's how it starts.
You know, the believer, Fox has got some kind of confirmation bias about wanting to believe, or tends to see what he wants to see because he believes.
Yeah, see, the problem with that is, spoiler alert here, if you've never seen it, you might want to pause. His search for belief is intoxicating, and they actually end up reversing roles.
Yeah.
She's the one who believes, and he's the skeptic at the end.
Yeah. And part of his belief path makes it to where he can't believe anymore.
Right.
He gives up. It runs its course, so to speak. Fascinating. Are you a believer?
In what?
What's out there?
It depends on what you're referring to.
I'm referring to spacemen. Do you believe in them?
Do I believe in spacemen? I think... Okay, this is a big question. I think statistically, yes. Probability, yes. And spiritually, yes.
Psychic phenomena?
Absolutely.
Skinwalkers?
Yes. So, I have to qualify. I think that what people label their observations aren't always the whole truth. So, have you ever heard the parable about, you know, there's an elephant and there's someone at the head and the tail and the side, and they all see something different,
right? Right.
But they're not getting the whole picture.
Right,
I
right.
think that kind of happens.
Sure.
With unknown phenomenon.
Yeah, I think I'm with you. Lindsay and I recently watched the documentary called, was it a series? Yeah, it was multiple episodes.
Yeah, docu-series.
Docu-series. I forget the name.
Mother God.
Mm-hmm. But it was centered on this lady who created an internet following and had this New Age style belief that she was God incarnate, and a lot of additional things were ascribed to it. And as she grew her following, it became more and more outlandish, you know, and it was something to behold. But I'll be quite honest with you, as I was watching it, I was shooketh. It really bothered me, all joking aside. I was finding myself being disturbed at people's responses to questions, and what disturbed me was my ability to relate with some of the people that were following.
Like you couldn't relate?
No.
Oh,
like
that?
Yes.
So some of the followers of Mother God, you could see yourself in.
They were saying things that made sense to me, like, oh, I'd had a, you know, they gave me a calm sense of peace, and I felt better, and no one ever really listened to me, and, you know, a lot of positive style phrases that, out of context, could have been just seen as really positive and good and beneficial and normal and great, you know. In context, you're thinking, oh my gosh, how can someone do this? And so it really bothered me. And it took me days to really process what it was that made me think that way. And I think part of it was I had not too long ago listened to another podcast called The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill. Now, I'm going to pause right there and kind of switch a little bit, because Mars Hill and our megachurch have some shared relationships, and there's some shared history there. And what I didn't really tell anybody at the time was years and years ago when Mars Hill, the church in Seattle, that was led by a person named Mark Driscoll, was on the rise. I was really secretly trying to figure out how to uproot our family and move there. And I didn't bother you, Lindsay, with that information, because I didn't really, number one, I'm an internal processor, so all of that was going on internally. Number two, I couldn't think of a way to make it happen, so I kind of let it sit, and I thought to myself, well, if God wanted this to happen, then God would make it happen. So, now that podcast, The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill, goes into great detail about the life cycle of Mark Driscoll's early ministry, the rise of that church, how it spread, and ultimately how it fell apart and how it kind of disintegrated. And listening to that podcast was extremely therapeutic for me because of how much I related to the stories of the people. Because, by the way, it was put on by Christianity Today, and they went and they interviewed a lot of folks that were there at the time, and they got personal stories, and it was just eerie to hear how much of what they experienced was similar to what I experienced, and I think what we experience at our megachurch. And that podcast had wrecked me. Like, it had already, like, devastated me, because I felt what I hadn't felt all over again, or what I hadn't processed all over again. But it was good, but also bad, if you know what I'm saying. Like, when you process sad things, it can have that effect. So, in watching Mother God documentary, seeing those folks do what I was thinking about doing made me feel like I was gullible enough to be whisked into a cult. I don't know that you're susceptible to the same thing that I was susceptible to.
To cults?
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what is a cult?
Okay. I'm glad you said that. I have here from the Cult Education Institute, the 10 things that are characterized, warning signs to look out for. Number one, absolute authoritarianism without accountability.
Okay.
Number two, zero tolerance for criticism or questions.
Okay.
Number three, lack of meaningful financial disclosure regarding budget. Number four, unreasonable fears about the outside world that often involve evil conspiracies and persecutions. Five, a belief that former followers are always wrong for leaving and there is never a legitimate reason for anyone else to leave. Number six, records, books, articles, or programs documenting the abuses of leader or group. Sorry, that's actually number seven. Number six was abusive members. So number six and number seven are about the abusive members. And then, hey, there's been a record of that kind of abuse. Number eight is followers feeling like they're never able to be good enough. Number nine, a belief that the leader is right all the time, at all times. And finally, 10, a belief that the leader is the exclusive means of knowing truth or giving validation.
So which one of those do you feel like opened you up to be susceptible?
Well, it wasn't really which one of those opened me up to be susceptible. It was, I could not have clearly seen this list of 10 in either our church, Mars Hill, or any really evangelical popular ministry, really, at the time.
Why? Why could you not have seen it?
Because I wanted to believe.
Oh, okay. You were willfully ignorant to those things.
I just don't know that that's ignorance. I don't think
it's... Meaning you're choosing not to see it.
Oh, in that sense, yes. But I don't even think I'm... No,
it's on a subconscious level. That's why it's called ignorant.
Okay. I'd have to think about that a little bit more, but I wanted to believe in the things that were being said. So the things that looked like cults were not visible to me. The thing that made it cult-ish or cult-like weren't highlighted. They're hard to see. They're actually really hard to see now, I think, for most folks, unless they're specifically, if you go through it line by line, like, okay, so the first one is absolute authoritarianism without accountability. Now, a lot of evangelical churches, especially at the megachurch size, they're not really a part of a larger governing body. They're just doing their own thing. They are not accountable to any other external organization.
Right. They don't have a review board, if you will.
Right. I mean, internally they do.
Sure.
But
externally is right. The point.
Correct. Correct. So nobody really, you don't really think about that. You just kind of give it a pass. But I think that's kind of a true.
That's a thing. Yeah.
That's a thing. The second one, this zero tolerance for criticism or questions. I mean, zero tolerance. I'll say most my experiences, low tolerance. Maybe not zero, right. But real low. And that translates to effectual zero tolerance.
Yeah.
There's no, you don't go and say, hey, this thing about evangelical Christianity seems kind of wonky. Let's just amend it. Let's talk about it. Yeah, that doesn't happen.
That's true.
So it is what it is at face value.
I guess I can see that in my experiences. I asked a lot of difficult questions out of ignorance because I wasn't raised in that faith system. And I was met with silence. So it wasn't like I was punished. I just was given a lot of silence for my questions.
Well, but I think the point is that there's not open dialogue there.
Right.
You know, and even if you do bring challenging questions, a lot of time they're like, let's take this offline. Let's take this offline. Where you can kind of control.
Although
that.
Although I did have a couple times where someone would actually get very upset with me in my mind, I placed that into a space where they didn't know the answer, and I challenged their worldview. And it messed up their equilibrium, ability to be themselves.
Because we haven't got there yet, but that's one of the later ones. The worldview.
Yeah, because people derive their identity from, I mean, you did read them, so.
Right.
Right.
So, like, going down, a belief that the leader is right all the time and the leader has the exclusive means of knowing the truth or giving validation. What's weird to me, not weird, but what I think you're honing in on is when megachurch pastors will go for maybe a sabbatical or go away to hear from God, to get the next vision. And that's very common, you know, for that leader to go and hear from God to then tell us, what did God say? What are we supposed to be doing? I feel like that falls into this cult-like stuff. Like, okay, we all can't hear God. I mean, we're told we can kind of hear God, but, you know, God forbid you're actually, like, you stand up, like a parishioner would just stand up and give the vision of what the church should be, and then the leadership goes, oh, yeah, it's a good idea. Let's do that, John. Thanks. I'm so glad you listened to God. You know, that doesn't happen.
I'll never forget. We were in at a friend's church, an AME church, which I absolutely loved. It was adorable. But it was so small that you could hear all the conversation from front to back. It was like a tiny little beautifully made wooden church. And the preacher said something about, and he said something about, about Jesus's bones being broken on the cross. And I was like, I said out loud, I thought, I don't think that's true. And I was used to a larger congregation. And he was like, what? And we like had a whole conversation in the middle with everybody listening, you know. And I was appreciative of that. I was appreciative of that sort of back and forth candor. But in a large church, you don't have that opportunity. And I think where I see that later on in your cult qualification list, what I saw was most people in larger churches, they don't derive understanding on their own. They only wait for the head pastor to tell them how to understand the Bible. And for me, the reason why I may not be susceptible to that is I am almost never that way. I almost always derive my own meaning, and I'll take outside input, but it doesn't weigh as heavy as my own.
It's a really good point, because I think I definitely, me personally, went the route of, what am I supposed to believe? What is right? Let me look at John Calvin. Let me look at Martin Luther. You know, let me look at...
Don't forget Wesley. What about John Smith?
No, not John Smith. He's a cult. He's a cult leader, John Smith.
Wait. Oh, but what's the difference in...
Well, that's this discussion, right? So, yeah. I think your example, though, is interesting, because you were debating with the pastor of a church about a thing that was published.
Discussion. It was published.
It was published. And because it was published, you could clearly say, oh, here it is or here it isn't. It wasn't like, I heard from God and God alone, and therefore what I receive is holy more than what you've received is holy. The leader and the leader only can receive a vision from God as part of this cult-like behavior.
Sure.
You know, I saw it in Mother God. I saw it in Mark Driscoll at Mars Hill. Extremely charismatic teacher, and it would hit all the strings, the heartstrings for me. And I wanted to be around it, and the energy around it, you know, from watching from afar, I was like, oh my gosh, I feel like that's God saying things and doing things. And
when you receive from somebody something that changes your perspective or has a hugely, whether it's positive or negative, a huge effect on your life and how you see the world and how you conduct, you know, in everyday life, those people, they kind of bypass that door in your thought processes that says, like, hey, should I be listening or not?
Oh my gosh.
And it kind of gets a back door. You get like so backstage entrance. And so those people...
It bypasses a critical thinking element.
So those people, well, they become trusted advisors. And those people, if you're not careful, because nobody's perfect, obviously. If you're not careful, those people, if they start going off the rails, it's easy to go with them. In this series, I think what you first said is, you know, the people who had followed Mother God received... You know, they were enlightened by being around her. They were full of peace by being around her. I personally don't believe, my personal belief is that you shouldn't seek happiness and peace, because a life without...
That is a classic Lindsayism.
I'm about to explain it. Listen, a life without challenges is nothing more than an avoidant life.
This is going to be on your tombstone.
She didn't avoid the bad stuff.
No. It's going to be, she didn't seek happiness or peace.
So wait, let me say that there's a difference. There's a difference between inner peace, which I do understand that concept. And to me, inner peace is like, in this really difficult situation, I can find a way to be okay and to be resilient and to look for hopeful things for my future, even though I'm in the midst of something difficult. And then this other kind of peace that I don't really understand, because I don't feel that way. But what I've heard is that people really just want a life without conflict, confrontation, disaster, you know, sadness, well, and hardships.
As it relates to like a religion or a belief system or a worldview, they want the world to make sense to them. And so how better to have it make sense as someone that is official gives you a way to think about things. You receive a benefit from it, an actual benefit. You find peace and calm, sure, and whatnot. And so that you keep listening. And you're really wise to point out that as soon as that track has been laid,
it's now easy to keep going on it.
It's easy to keep going on it.
Yeah. And I do also want to say that you have told me over and over again, I don't know where you heard the quote, like meditation, the problem with meditation is it works.
That's Peter Rollins.
Peter Rollins.
Yeah, that's so basically the only guy I quote.
Meditation is emptying your mind, you know, and being quiet. But there is appropriate circumstances to be thinking about things.
Right.
And if you're always emptying your mind, you're avoiding the things you should be considering.
Correct.
So that's kind of the point. If you're always searching for peace and happiness, you have no resiliency, no adaptability against hardships. And the problem with looking to an outside source for that is because it may work for a while, but I have never, ever seen in my life any religion, any person, any hobby, any object that will permanently displace hardships.
Well, I mean, it kind of goes back to that, our previous episode. In the previous episode, we talked about filling the hole, but in this case, you're talking about, you know, overcoming an obstacle, but it's a very similar thing.
Absolutely.
Right? Because the quote that everybody throws out is God won't give you what
more
you can't
than you can handle.
More than you can handle.
I disagree.
Right.
I disagree.
Right. I mean, it's a commonplace, you know, and to that effect, I remember a dear person in our home church ministry that once said, who had a child that passed at an early age, and you know, they were crying, and the question was to me, why did God do that? Mm-hmm. And I was gutted. I don't have an answer for that. You know, I said as much kind of at the time, like there's no way for me to know what's in the heart and mind of God as that kind of those kinds of things happen. And I surely couldn't have said, well, I don't know if there is, may not even be a God. It just could be the shit world we live in, the shit things happen.
Well,
you know, let alone imagine the power that I had in that moment to basically create a version of God for these folks. And I hate to say it that way, but I had said something that gave them peace and calmness, now that's an attribute of God that they would have taken away with them.
Right.
You know.
And like I say, that feeling of loss and sorrow is an indicator of how much love and connection there was.
Right.
And if you replace that, if you take that away, if you take away your loss and sorrow, you're diminishing that love and connection that you had. So it's important, I think, to understand that when people look to religion, it is oftentimes to relieve pain. Hmm. And that's normal. I mean, everybody seeks to relieve themselves from pain, but you can't have permanent relief of that. You can have temporary, like you can have respite, but not permanent.
You're right. You're right to mention that too, because another one of my personal stories is with my ex-wife. You know, we weren't in a good place, and I was told by a dear friend, hey, if you read this Bible, your marriage to my ex-wife at the time would get better. And, you know, obviously it didn't. But that promise of, hey, this will make your life right, is really that reaching out and trying to solve that problem, to nullify the pain, to move past that obstacle.
What's that movie series Fireproof, that we talk about as being the same concept,
right?
Like, oh, all you have to do is pray and all of a sudden your life gets better.
Correct.
And then what is disappointing to people is that that's not always how it works. Sometimes it does.
Right. And the real tragedy is that it works sometimes.
Well, it works a lot. And I have a very active prayer life, and I feel like if I were to consider my answered prayers, I would be a spoiled child in that, in the sense that, you know, I do feel like there's been a lot of relief and a lot of good that has come of that. But if I had all the prayers that I prayed for answered, like all of them yeses, the things that I've prayed for, my life would be terrible right now, because I don't always know what's good for me.
Yeah, I mean, I know that that's a common refrain, and I know that you're genuine in when you say it, but I personally find no value in that sentiment, and that is, for me, my perspective. And the reason is...
What sentiment do you not find value in?
That people don't know what they should... Like, they don't know what to pray for. Like, mm-hmm. if they got everything they asked for, their life would be worse off. I don't know that I believe that or not. Right now, I don't. But it's not like a set stone for me. But
I have a similar experience with my ex, where I was praying that the relationship would resolve itself. And I would have missed my relationship with you had it resolved itself. Now, I don't know that my life would have been terrible, but there's indicators that it wouldn't be as great. So, I mean, I'm glad that that prayer wasn't answered.
Right. And that is a great example. That is a great example. I guess, you know, Steve Jobs once, the guy from Apple, said once that customers don't actually know what they want.
Right.
So in that sense, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
I guess where I'm at in my life now is I have, and this goes back to cult behavior and leadership and charismatic leaders, is I had given up so much agency for myself already to these other dead church fathers.
Yeah.
What do I believe? You know, again, I always fall back to Calvin and Luther. What should I believe? Right. Or even contemporary. Right. What should I believe? Mark Driscoll. What right. should I believe? R.C. Sproul, you know.
Right.
What is the right answer here? I don't want to think. I don't want to process. I just want to know the right answer. And that is, paired with the desire to believe, is what made me a dangerous follower. Dangerous
well,
for
then
myself.
There's tons of dangerous followers.
I agree. That's
there's
why I think
there's tons of people
who
are susceptible.
Yes, and I think a lot of people that are seeking and want to believe, but also don't want to spend the energy to process themselves. Then they want an answer, and the person to give them the answer is easy to follow because they're very charismatic, whether it's in speech or you know whatever.
Yeah,
they'll follow. They'll follow that person blindly, and they'll do dumb things.
See, I don't feel like I have that. I don't feel like I have that.
I don't think you have that.
But I do. I want to tell you why I don't have that, okay? I think I'm pretty sure I know why I don't have that. I think it's from, like, some really traumatic things that have happened to me.
Mm.
And that broke down my ability to fully put my faith in other people.
Right.
So while I do care for people and I have, you know, I accept input, I never go against what I have on the inside. And what I have on the inside is so much stronger because of, you know, the situation I was in where I really had to decide, is this real? And it turned out to not be, you know, the trauma that I was in. It was life-altering in a way where how I see the world and everyone in it changed. So I really think that that's why I'm not susceptible in that way.
Right. And I can see how you would have had resiliency where my history is.
Well, the therapists call it trust issues.
Yeah. Right. Right. And me growing up in a, you know, Southern Baptist, Midwest culture, you know, my parents, I felt loved and
didn't lock the doors.
So right there, I'm already at a deficit because the world is safe.
Yeah.
You know. So let's talk about abuse.
Okay.
Number six in that list is abusive members.
Yeah. So I'm pretty good at spotting certain kinds of abuse, but it also makes me susceptible to other kinds of abuse.
Okay.
So where I'm susceptible to abuse is the desire to be accepted. And I think that a lot of people actually are susceptible to that. They want to be they want to belong, they want to be accepted, they want to be a part of the group, of the tribe. And I think that's okay and that's normal. Where it's maybe difficult is when you pair that with somebody who has that kind of one-way knowledge, you know, one-way communication about, and we're not just talking about like book knowledge, we're talking about behavior modification. How should you live? How should you talk to others? How should you interact with others? How should you dress? Who should you marry? How should you marry them? You
know,
when how should young? You marry them? Right? Should you have children or not? There's a whole list of things that are influenced by religion. And so, yeah, that's a scary vulnerability, I think, that people don't even know they have.
Yeah, 6 is the abuse of members. 7 is a record of records or books or articles or programs documenting the abuses of the leader or group. So right away, my very first thought is, was there a record of abuse specifically? And I would say no.
Right.
However.
Like there was no sexual abuse or like violence, physical violence going on.
That isn't to say that those things didn't happen with different folks, okay? And this is where it gets a little muddy, but also
we don't know all the stories.
Well, true, but like let me throw a curveball. Does the abuse of children by Catholic priests fall into this category?
What do you mean?
That there's a number 7. Records, books, articles, or programs documenting the abuses of the leader or group.
I mean, yeah, but I don't know why you're asking that.
What I'm saying is that a check mark to the list of, is Christianity a cult? Does it have a marker from a religious and or from this, you know, definition of a cult?
I mean, have you heard of the Crusades?
Yeah, a very good point. Right, point taken. Point taken.
It doesn't have to be, you know, sexual abuse. There's, in the history of Christianity, there's tons of recorded abuses.
Okay, so let's back up for a second.
Yeah.
So, historically speaking, and researching this for this episode, the word cult, historically, is not a negative word.
Right.
It's actually just a descriptor of, like, group.
Right.
For instance, there are cults inside Catholicism, and I forget the name, Cult of Virgin Mary, I think was one that I was reading.
Yeah.
And they're just, there's different subgroups inside Catholicism and other religions, and it was no big deal to say the word cult, but
right,
cult recently.
Like
right. You know, now we have Charles Manson. Of course,
maybe.
That probably is true too. But David Koresh of Waco, you know, there are modern day cult leaders that we tend to think of when we think of cults. But the truth is, historically, cult wasn't necessarily a bad word. I guess the question I'm asking is if I look at this list of 10 things that is quote unquote negative cult behavior. Is Christianity a cult? Now, I have a pre-answer, but I want to hear what you think on that.
I mean, tell me your answer.
I don't know that Christianity is a cult. I think that's too generic of a term. I do think that there are Christian groups, whether they're megachurches or not, you know, smaller groups of people, 100% that there are cults that are Christian cults.
Okay, so like you're saying, Christianity is too broad of a term to use under the
yeah. It's almost
cult.
A meaningless phrase now because
right,
like
so
what
many
is
segments,
it?
Right? So there's cults within. Okay, I'm following.
Yeah. The reason I think it's important to ask that question of ourselves and to have this conversation is what do the followers look like of a cult? What are they capable of doing or not doing? What does a charismatic leader look like? What are they capable of doing and not doing? And when you pair those things together, what do you get? You know, you get a bona fide cult. And some cults, you know, maybe don't end super bad. But some cults end terribly, where there's mass suicide or there's mass sexual assault on its members, or there's laundering of money or subjugation or human trafficking, mm-hmm. you know, and those are terrible things. Those should not happen. And so watching Mother God made me think, oh my gosh, I was looped into that. Like, not into Mother God, but I fell into a cult-like understanding to not necessarily my megachurch, but I was hook, line, and sinkered with Mars Hill and Mark Driscoll. I was in.
Well, I think...
And the only thing that saved us was, you know, 1,800 miles of distance between the two of us.
I mean, that's good.
Yeah.
I think that there... One of the things in play when discussing this is probably confirmation bias. Mm-hmm. And you talked about it being difficult to leave a cult. I think that the confirmation bias is a big deal. So you've already bought in and become a member. And to transition into, first of all, leaving the group of people that you're used to spending time with is difficult. To change who you've seen yourself as being, like your personal identity, mm-hmm. how you see yourself, how you interact with, you know, your community that you've built.
Yeah.
And then to change your perspective, like to actually notice those things that are cult-like. I think the confirmation bias is like, oh, well, nah, they're not doing that. You know, they're good people. And after so many of those excuses, if you've never been in an abusive relationship, it does not set off alarm bells. And you're not thinking, even when something bad happens, you'll say to yourself, you'll make excuses about it and say, you know, oh, it was just a bad day. Oh, it was the circumstances. It was the, you know, it was situational. That's not who they really are.
There's actually an episode on that Mars Hill podcast that talks about why did they put up with so much for so long, you know, when all mm-hmm. the negative things were happening. And the common refrain was because we were doing so much good at the same time.
Right.
And so you kind of look the other way. You're like, oh, this wouldn't have happened. This good thing wouldn't have happened without this bad thing.
And I you know, my past, I've been in an abusive relationship before I met you. And, it wasn't always bad. Mm. It wasn't always bad. And the good days were really good. You know, and you always think, this is a fluke. This is a one-off. This isn't how it's supposed to be. This isn't normal. And it's really difficult to accumulate those warning signs together in your mind because you really want to be loved and accepted. People just want to be loved and accepted.
And you're willing to take some level of shit for that to happen.
I mean... In relationships, you would be ludicrous to think that there's no
right
back and forth that happens, no hurt that happens.
Right.
It does, right. You know.
So you kind of deal with some of it anyway.
Right.
And you swallow maybe the pill. You get like, you just get where you overlook a little more, and it happens slowly over time to where before you know it, big things are happening and you're numb to it. You don't see it. You don't see it for what it is.
I think one of the most dangerous practices that I see people, and I normally don't say things out loud to people that I observe because I'm a super observant person, but I see people all the time, providing their own distractions to cover their discomfort. Mm. And I think one of the most dangerous things you can do is distract yourself. Like, oh, it was a really bad day at work. My boss yelled at me, and I'm just going to go hang out with some friends, you know, whatever.
Spend time with drinks.
I was thinking with my dogs, but okay. Sure. But you know, you provide that distraction, and kind of like the meditation things, it works. Distractions work.
Yeah.
And which I know we had talked about discussing in a later episode, recontextualization works.
You're right.
Which is, you take a negative situation and you try to think about it in a different perspective. And sometimes those can be delusional.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those can be delusional. So if you're following somebody and you're seeing the warning signs, you might say, oh, well, I don't know what they were actually doing. They probably didn't mean it that way. You know, watching the Mars Hill thing, some of the people were like, yeah, but he was such a great guy. And then sometimes he would just go into this rant. And in these few areas, it was negative, but he did a great job in these mm-hmm. other areas.
Right, right. Well, I guess, again, like we've been doing from previous episodes, this is a build to another conversation that we'll have in a little bit, or for another episode, where we look at a group of people that are primed to be leveraged by a charismatic leader and then make those same kind of compromises that they may not make normally, you know?
Right.
And there's a response here. And so I guess I'm just asking the question first and foremost to our listeners, and then acknowledging at the same time, I saw it in myself. I'm not impervious to this.
I'm not. I mean, we have different
vulnerabilities. Mine's different. Sure. But I think that I don't think you have the markers to kind of get sucked up like I did, you know?
That's not true. I have just been through something that taught me that lesson already.
Yeah.
Until you go through it, you don't know.
Yeah.
You don't know how dangerous trust can be.
Well, you know, I found it interesting because why don't we change is the question that I keep hearing. And there's this quote from Psychology Today that I found that said some cognitive researchers claim that the brain has to consume extra energy in the process of changing or rearranging beliefs, and that simple neurological laziness, the tendency to conserve glucose and oxygen, predisposes the brain to keeping the configurations as it already has. So to me, it's like our brain is even it doesn't want to change. And all I'm asking of myself these days is reassess, reevaluate, to me, that's why spiritual deconstruction is the word that I keep coming back to. I'm trying to deconstruct the thing that it is or that I was and get to a more pure version of whatever's there, and to reassess why I think what I think, who told me what to think. Well, was it important? Why did they tell me that, you know? And that process, I think, was not only just important for me, but I think it's important for most, if not all people, to A, maybe you really do believe. Maybe, you know what I'm saying? Like, maybe you are that true believer and you're head over heels for whatever that thing is or that group is or whatnot. And you've evaluated and you've had a critical look. And hopefully it's a net positive in the world and you're not harming yourself or others as a participant. But I think a lot of people that are mob mentality or follower mentality would do well to stop, think, listen, process, and ask yourself questions. You know, where did this come from? And is it good?
I have things to add if you don't mind.
Please.
So a study, a psychologist or psychiatrist, and had a group of college students. Basically, they set up a fake scenario. Everybody was in this class. They knew it was a fake scenario. And they said, okay, we're going to see if we can recreate the environment of a prison.
Mm.
So just randomly, like, here, you guys are guards. You guys are prisoners. And I think it was supposed to be a few months long. They were supposed to live and act as those things. Obviously, they weren't actual prisoners. They were all graduate college students, I believe. And this experiment devolved and deteriorated to the point where they had to stop within days.
Right.
Because of abuse.
The guards were abusing their power.
Yeah, and the fake prisoners were devolving to be, you know, to actual criminal activity. The guards were, they were on a power kick, and they were abusing their classmates as if they were less than them as humans. So that's the worst part of the story. My favorite part of the story is this, and I'll look it up. This doctor actually... This doctor, after this experiment, I don't know how long after, actually developed a different kind of company. It was an experiment that he turned into a company called the Hero Project. And what he discovered is if people observe others doing heroic acts, like standing up for somebody who's being bullied or helping somebody who's in need, if they observe other people doing that, they're more likely to then do it themselves, right? Hmm. And so there's these mirroring neurons in our brain, and what we see other people doing, we begin to emulate on a subconscious level, like whether you know it or not. And go ahead.
I was just going to say that is such a core core human thing,
yeah.
You know, like I've always said to the kids, show me your friends and I'll show you your future. Like similar thing. Like we just emulate the people we're around naturally. Even if you try not to, you're just going to kind of go with the flow, so to speak. And so it can be incredibly difficult to see or to be agents of change when the current is so strong. So when there's a strong current, it can be incredibly difficult to be the one to stand up and say, wait a minute.
But that is contagious as well.
Right.
I did find it was Dr. Philip Zimbardo, and he was Stanford University, and it was the Stanford Prison Experiment, if anyone wants to look it up. Fascinating story. But we are designed that way. We're designed to emulate others. It's a survival instinct.
Right, right.
And so when you see someone who you admire, who you think is pointing you towards a better you, emulating them and allowing these like negative events to pass without much of a objection is natural. And to this degree, like, some crazy stuff can happen and you won't even realize how much you've fallen into that category.
Have you
ever been hypnotized? No.
Me either, actually. Now you say that. But I was going to actually ask, as part of this process these last few years, I think I know you have, but I just kind of want to hear your words on it. Have you stopped and reevaluated, like, who you are, what you believe, where do you stand, what happened to me?
Yes. And one of the biggest points of me leaving vocational church is that I started to believe that my value was at a diminished level than it actually was. And I was fighting this understanding that there was a difference, there was a cognitive dissonance between what I had already assessed myself to be and what I was being told I was. And I actually had to make myself smaller to fit in that box that Christianity put on me. Well, I understand that you carry a lot of guilt for that, but it was not you. I subjected myself to that willingly because I wanted to belong. And I did belong for a while. But I had to be more quiet. I had to be more submissive. I had to not ask as many questions. I had to not share my ideas. I had to not reach for positions of leadership when I was well-deserved and well-skilled and, dare I say, you know, blessed in those areas. Mm-hmm. And so making myself small looked like a lot, a lot. I had to cover my tattoos.
You have tattoos?
Yeah, we already talked about this. Remember?
Yeah, I know.
But it's difficult because conforming to other people's perspectives to belong is a part of this.
Mm.
Is a part of this. And that's another danger.
It feels so good to belong.
It does. It does.
It feels so good.
And it feels so bad to be on the outside of that.
It feels terrible.
Right.
To not belong.
Especially when you, like, I don't experience when I'm not around somebody, I don't experience the same distance that other people tell me they experience. So if I was best friends with somebody in first grade, I still share a love for them.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe because I have a really good memory. But of them and at that time.
I don't remember any first graders.
I don't know who they are now, but I remember quite a few.
Mm.
So maybe because I have like a good grasp on those memories, I still have a lot of, I feel the connection there.
Mm-hmm.
But in multiple times, you know, when I decided to walk away from my addiction, I had to change my friends, and that was a really hard process. And it was a similar process. It was a similar process leaving the church as getting clean from addiction, because the circle of friends had to change, the behaviors had to change, the worldview had to change, how you see yourself has to change. You know, there's so much that goes in there. You have to basically, like you said, rewire everything in the brain. And that's hard.
Yeah, that's a profound observation.
But I don't think everyone has the ability to do that, honestly.
Hmm. You know, it's interesting, recording this, I usually think, oh, I've said a lot, and therefore I feel like I've emptied a bucket.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's not the right visual. I feel conclusion usually after recording. I feel like this opened more for me than it did resolve.
Maybe that's because I didn't share any notes with you. You didn't know what I was going to say.
No. It's not that. I think there's more for me to think about regarding predisposition for wanting to believe, finding a group of people to want to believe in that thing with, like, I belong here. We believe in Loch Ness Monster, or here's Bigfoot, or
Helldivers.
Helldivers for democracy. Yeah, nobody's going to get that joke.
There'll be two people.
You have to send us a message if you get that joke. And really, I feel like I still have internal work to really understand a predisposition to be part of a cult or part of a mob or part of a group, or want the desire to belong that might make me choose less so that I'm not belonging.
Yeah, I think that's really the work that everyone has to do, including myself. I literally do not have the answers on how to solve that riddle.
Mm.
But I think knowing it's there is probably the first step.
Yeah. I guess what I would say is ask yourself these questions. It's terribly uncomfortable. You know, I watched Mother God, a docuseries, and I hated myself watching it. Mm-hmm. I'm being hyperbolic, but like I really was like, oh my God, I did not realize I could have been in this episode, not for necessarily Mother God, but if there was a docuseries on Mars Hill, I could have been one of the people like, yep, I was going to sign my family up to, you know, do X, Y, Z.
There was a docuseries on Mars
Hill. I know it was a podcast. You know, there's still internal work for me to do. And as I've stated on the website, well, I'll say it here, you know, I just, at this point, I don't want to look for answers. I just want to ask questions. And I want to collect questions, ask myself these questions, think about them, reassess, reevaluate. And so for me, I don't need to know the answer, or I don't need to know an end solution, but I just am realizing, oh, there's a lot more questions for me about this space.
Well, it's kind of back to X-Files.
Mm.
It's the searching for truth. that is really satisfying. The finding of truth isn't as satisfying as the search.
You know, there's a whole philosophical view on that and the object of desire. Maybe we'll talk about that one of these episodes.
Okay, until next time.
This has been
The Weightless Space.
Thanks.
Take care.
Bye-bye.